Hello, this is Michael Stone, the host of Conversations. We're committed to bringing you leading-edge thinkers in the areas of environmental restoration, social justice, and spiritual fulfillment. On our program, we look for positive solutions to local and global issues that leave you touched, moved, and inspired to action. Our weekly guests include local and global experts and concerned citizens working together to heal the wounds that separate, alienate, and marginalize people. Every day it's a new look at how can we begin to protect the devastation that's happening on the planet. And with me today is one of the great writers and ecologists and way more than that. Derek Jensen is an American author, environmental activist. He's a leading voice of cultural dissent. He explores the nature of injustice, how civilizations devastate the natural world, and how human beings retreat in denial at the destruction of the planet. His work examines the central question: if the destruction of the natural world isn't making us happy, then why are we doing it? Jensen just wrote with several other people The Deep Green Resistance, which we had on our two pledge drives ago, and his new book, Dreams, is just out. An amazing book, and I'm very happy to have you back, Derek. Welcome back to Conversations.
Hey, thank you for having me. And also, I wanted to apologize for being a minute or so late, and I mentioned this to you off air, but I was a little bit mysterious. I said, you know, I had an outside emergency, but the real truth is that I was sitting outside looking up at a baby bear sitting way up in a tree, and I lost track of the time.
That's a good reason, you know? That's way better than the dog ate my homework. I think it's a worthy goal to be sitting and watching and paying attention to a bear in a tree. This new book, Dreams, is something I think you've been wanting to write for quite a while, and it's kind of a, it's not really a shift, but the way you've written it is very interesting. And I'd like to just talk a little bit about what called you to do this particular book and, you know, about dreams. What would happen if we didn't have dreams?
Well, the book is really about, in many ways, where dreams come from. And I've wanted to write it for a long time. I believe my experience is that there's a dream giver, that dreams aren't entirely unconscious, but that someone gives them to us. And it's like also when I write about the muse. I only learned recently, maybe 6 months or a year ago, that the disbelief in a muse is only about 300 years old. It really came with the Enlightenment, which, of course, is not particularly surprising. But before that, everybody presumed that muses are where art came from or where a lot of thoughts came from. And I wanted to write about that for a long time, but I never did, because other books would impinge, because it seemed really a luxury that we can't afford to write about where dreams come from when the world's being murdered. You know, it's like I've got too many other things to do. There, you know, why should I spend a year and a half or however long writing a book about where dreams come from when 200 species went extinct today and 200 species are going to go extinct tomorrow, and when indigenous languages are being destroyed at a relatively even faster rate than wild species? And then the conversion for me as to why I had to write the book came when I realized that, you know, for years I've been saying that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being, so many indigenous people have said to me that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that even the most open-minded Westerners perceive listening to the natural world as a metaphor as opposed to the way the world really works. And that's really fundamental, because if you perceive the world as consisting of resources to be exploited, that's how you'll treat it. And if you conceive the world as persisting of other beings to enter into relationship with, that's what you'll do too. But there's another difference that I haven't talked about so much, which is traditionally, and I want to be really clear, and I say this in the book, and I say this everywhere, I'm not indigenous, I don't claim to be indigenous. What I claim to be is a member of a living universe. And anyway, the point is that a lot of indigenous cultures have also had relationships with ancestors, with muses, with dream givers. You know, if I asked once this friend of mine, Jeanette Armstrong, Okanagan Indian writer and activist, where dreams come from, and she laughed and said, oh, everybody knows animals give them to us. And then later on, I was talking to Vine Gloria, the Indian writer, and I asked him, and he was Dakota, and he said, the spirits give them to us. And I said, well, you know, Jeanette said that animals give them to us. What's the deal? And he started laughing. He said, well, of course she'd say that, because she's from more in the Pacific Northwest, where your entire cosmology is about maintaining integrity when you have all these different beings impinging on you. And the same would be true in the American Southeast, where he was talking about, I believe, Cherokee cosmology, where everything has to do with, you've got all these beings who can hitchhike into you psychically, you know, like you walk by a tree and it jumps into a human for a minute. And this is just a standard part of their cosmology. And how do you maintain your integrity as opposed to the plains, where you have a few larger animals? And so, of course, they're going to have an entirely different mythology around dreams. And so then I start working more on dreams, and I start looking at the notions of dream interpretation. And it's pretty interesting because you don't see very many Western books on dream interpretation that begin from the premise that dreams are gifts from the outside, from somewhere else. You know, all basically dream interpretation, for the most part in Western society, is psychological.
Right.
And so this is all interesting. I'm still trying to figure out, you know, why I should write this book. And I realized that maybe part of the reason that the dominant culture is killing the planet is because it dismisses or demonizes or ignores these messages from other sides. There was a thing on The Onion, I don't know if you saw it, the thing on The Onion just like a week ago saying, it was a press release from the Earth saying, look, we're trying to make clear to you, we want you all to leave because you're being so nasty. We're sending you tornadoes. We're sending you hurricanes. Can't you get the message? Cut this crap out. And mix that with something, probably the smartest thing I said in my book, A Language Older Than Words, is that I talked about how I believe that when we perceive the world the way we normally do, we're misperceiving it almost entirely. Because how would the world be different? How would our experience in the world be different if we perceive waking reality like we perceive dreams? What I mean by that is if I have a dream that has a horse in it, it's like, oh my gosh, it's a horse. It means this. It means that. You know, what do horses mean? And if in waking reality I see a horse, it's just another horse, you know? It's like, okay, so just, you know, I was late into the phone because I was out looking at a bear. It's like, wow, that was exciting. That was fun. But what would it mean if I had a dream in which I saw a bear up a tree? It's like, oh, then it takes on all this significance. And there's, I believe it was Claude Levi-Strauss, the anthropologist, who said that he characterized indigenous peoples as living in a blaze of reality. And so what would it be like to walk through our days recognizing that others have meaning and that there's all these communications going back and forth? And I'm not saying that the bear was up a tree for me. I'm just saying that all life is full of meaning.
Just to add to what you're saying, you know, I've been down in the Amazon quite a bit with Pachamama Alliance, and I remember down there when we started working on rainforest issues, and the Shuar elder said, well, this is great, you're coming down to work with us and help us down here, but it's not going to make any difference. It's not going to make any difference until you change the dream of the North. And, you know, at first I thought, oh, well, you know, that's a poetic way of saying it. But no, it's not a poetic saying. It's an entirely different fundamental reality. Every morning they get up and drink ayahuasca tea, talk about their dreams and how it's going to shape their actions in being in the world, the ontology of their expression into the world. And I think that's, you know, partly what you're saying there is talking about the how huge the reality is different when you allow those other shades, other sides, as you call them, to inform us as in the bigger picture.
Well, I love that. And I think about how, you know, so many indigenous people have said that they were given original instructions. And part of the way that we get those instructions is through the dreams. That's someone talking to us. And I would contrast, and I do contrast that in the book, by the way, with the notion of original instructions versus the notion of original sin. There's a lot of the book where I speak out pretty strongly against Christianity and then science. I think it's my strongest attack on science yet. And one of the things I talk about, and the way this is going to come back to dreams, is everything I was thinking about the world being meaningful. But one of the things that monotheism did that was really powerful that allows the planet to be destroyed is it took the meaning out of the planet and put it into this repository called God, who lives somewhere else. That God is where the meaning lies, as opposed to God being gods, goddesses, as opposed to the meaning being around us. And then that's actually the heavy lifting. And then what science did with the Enlightenment, with turning the perception of the world into a machine, is just turn out the light way out there. That takes the rest of the meaning away. You know, if you read Richard Dawkins, if you read a lot of the mechanistic scientists, they're all very that life is essentially meaningless.
And yeah,
it's an entirely different way to live. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to that whole, the connection you made to me was the most powerful thing in the book, the connection between science, capitalism, and Christianity. And you hammered Dawkins pretty hard, but mainly the scientific mind. But as you were saying in your book, I think that he gets more hits than Mick Jagger. And this is the worldview of contemporary society.
Well, it really is. And one of the things I say at one point, pretty late in the book, is that if you asked 10,000 scientists if they believe that the world was created for human consumption, probably the vast majority would laugh at you and say, of course not, that evolution is non-hierarchical, that, you know, no, it wasn't put here. But then if you watch them when they go back to work,
see their actions.
What are their actions doing? And their actions are converting the earth to human use. And so when actions speak louder than words, you know, then they're acting as though the world has been created for human use. And that's an extraordinary thought. I mean, how would you feel if somebody said to you that the world was created for ruby-throated hummingbird use? And the entire world is created only for their use, and they're going to make these ruby-throated hummingbird superhighways, and they're going to destroy your habitat so they can make ruby-throated hummingbird stadiums. And can you imagine a hummingbird laptop computer, you know? Anyway, so they're going to do this. It's all just silly. You know, if somebody were to say the world was created for orangutans and the great orangutan god said so, or the great orangutan scientist said so, either way, and they're all converting the world to orangutan use, we would be going, oh my goodness, that's pretty silly, and it's pretty destructive, and we need to stop it.
And yet it's exactly what we're doing, as man is the pinnacle of creation.
And especially you know, white culture, especially the dominant culture, you know, this doesn't apply to the indigenous peoples who are, you know, being driven off their land as we speak. Or the poor, you know, right now the governments of Southeast Asia are planning on putting in, I believe, 11 dams on the lower Mekong. And, you know, that's going to absolutely devastate not only the Mekong River itself and the non-human beings who live there, but it will also devastate the livelihoods of the, I believe it's 1.5 million people who live along that part of the river. And then another question that comes up in the book that is really central to the book is, if the indigenous people really had connections to other sides and could attempt to call on allies from other sides, they had relations with their ancestors and all this, how has the dominant culture been able to win every time? Why couldn't they call on some sort of assistance to stop that dominant culture? And another question is, if the world really is alive, as I fully believe it is, if it's fully sentient, as I believe it is, then why hasn't it stopped this culture? Why
thrown us off, like the Onion article.
Thrown us off.
Right.
And, you know, why is it that white nose disease is killing bats instead of humans? I mean, what do the bats do? So I spend probably 300 or 400 pages giving a bunch of answers to this question, one possibility to these two questions. One possibility is that mechanistic science is right. And, if you're, you know, there are no beings on the other sides for the indigenous people to call on. And if they're spending time calling on them, they're wasting time they could have spent building guns. And, you know, if it's a well-armed, you know, military unit or facing off a bunch of people who are praying, we know who's going to win. And that's one possibility. And the reason the Earth hasn't fought back is for the same reason that your refrigerator doesn't fight back when you reach in to pull out some you know, lettuce, because it's simply not alive. And that's one possibility, which I don't believe, but that's one possibility. Another possibility is that Christianity is right, and there was a chosen people, you know, the monotheists, whether they're Jews, Christians, or Muslims, or any other monotheism, but they're the chosen people, and God's going to help them. And that's a possibility. I don't believe that one either. And I go through a whole bunch of possibilities, because I think I was talking to an American Indian friend of mine about this as I was writing the book, and I was sharing the book with her. And when I got to the point where I started asking that question, is how is it if they have got these connections that they always lost? And this friend said, you know, there's not an American Indian in North America who hasn't asked that question in the last 500 years. You know, this is a question we always ask. And it's a huge question. So another way to say all this is that, you know, when I wrote Endgame, I was explicitly leaving off the possibility of assistance from other sides. That there, you know, they've got all these premises about how the culture is inherently destructive and how we really need to fight back against it. We need to stop this culture from killing the planet. And one of the things I said is that we're not going to get help from the Great Mother, the Easter Bunny, you know, the Earth. You know, we need to do it ourselves. And that was a premise. That was the only premise in that book that I don't entirely agree with. All the others I'm very easily on board with. But that one, I put that premise in because I didn't want people to be able to use the excuse of, oh, we don't need to fight back because we're going to get some miracle help somewhere. And then in this book, I wanted to talk about the miraculous, which is something we don't talk about. And the miraculous can both, I think, help good sides and bad sides. One of the things that really helped break this open to me, and I'm sorry this conversation sort of wandering all over, but the book is about dreams, so of course it's going to, you know, go in different directions.
And I love the way you did that, too, that you would throw a dream in there in between, you know, different places, and it really adds to it. And I think if we were paying, I later on want to talk about more about our own dreams, but I think it made it very powerful, Derek, and wandering is fine. You know, this is a conversation so that people can engage in it themselves and thinking of it as we're going along, and so I appreciate your doing that.
Well, thank you. And, you know, that's one of the reasons I wanted to write this book, is that so often dreams and this whole notion of connection to other sides is so devalued at this point that, you know, there's a sense in which I feel with every book that this is going to be the book that permanently destroys my reputation. And for this book, the part that is really sort of reputation-destroying, you know, I'm scared about that, is that I'm saying, look, I got a muse. Look, I walk down this path, and a lot of times certain trees will talk to me and there are certain trees that if I'm stuck on writing something, if I walk past a certain patch of trees, a lot of times some answer will come to me right there. And there's a line that an Indian friend of mine quoted to me from a book that she just loved, saying that within her people and with indigenous peoples generally, there is a wide acceptance of the fact that non-consensual reality occurs. And when I read that, I had to try to understand it for a while. And what it means, or what I understand it to mean, is that among most people, okay, if you, me, and four other people are standing here, and all of a sudden one of us sees a deer, and the other four people don't see it, we try to come up with some explanation as to why we didn't see it, as opposed to simply accepting that maybe there was a deer that was seen by one person but not the others. A deer was present to one person, not the others. I was trying to talk the other day to a person I don't know very well, my dentist, and he's a fundamentalist Christian, and he was asking me what my next book was about, and it's like, oh my goodness, what am I going to say? And I said, well, it's about dreams. I said, you know, Christians might believe that God gives us dreams, and some other people might believe something else, and scientists might believe they come from the unconscious. And so what I come to, one of the things I come to having to do with dreams especially, but with everything, is every piece of knowledge requires faith. You know, everything requires faith. The belief, electricity, we don't really know how electricity works. We know that if we flip a switch, it goes on, but even the physicists don't actually know how it works. We've got metaphors for it. But really on an existential level, you can't, I mean, it's like Descartes said, even though I can't stand Descartes, you know, I think, therefore I am, that we can only know some certain things. Everything else takes a certain amount of faith.
Well, this could be a whole, this could be a whole book in itself, Derek. You were talking about in the book about the relationship of knowledge and faith. And is it ever possible to really ever get away from faith if you're actually seeking truth?
No, you can't get away from faith because you have to have faith. I mean, it takes a certain amount. I've never met you, you know, you're a voice on a phone.
Right.
And I don't actually know you exist, you know? You could, I mean, you could be a computer-generated voice. You could be, you know, I don't mean to get all trippy, but, you know, you could be a figment of my imagination, possibly.
It could be a dream.
It doesn't take a lot of faith to not believe this one. I'm just going to take some
I understand.
Faith, you know? It's not, I mean, everything takes some amount of faith. And so the point is, I said this to this fundamentalist Christian, the dentist, and he said back, no, the way you know something's true is if it's repeatable. That's why you do scientific experiments. And that's really interesting because that's, of course, the dominant mythology right now. But one of the things that does is that ignores willfulness. Things are repeatable only if they're not willful. Because you can ask me, like, we'll try this right now. Please ask me, and I'll respond. Please ask me, like, four times in a row how I'm doing.
How you doing, Derek?
Great.
How you doing?
Terrible.
Hey, Derek, how you doing?
None of your business.
How you doing, Derek?
Did you know that rocks are hard?
And water's wet.
Yeah. So my point is that if I'm a willful being, I can answer that simple question any way I want. And so repeatability carries with it certain assumptions. And that's something we don't talk about often enough. Because what if the universe is composed of other willful subjects? Then that kind of throws, I mean, that's one of the basic unstated assumptions of most of the mechanistic scientific worldview, is that other beings are objects who can be mathematically described, and the world itself can be mathematically described. But what if these others are willful? And this is, we see this everywhere. Even in the world, I never use the word ecosystem anymore. I use the word natural community. Because a system is like a stereo system. A system is mechanistic language. I'm not a fascist about it, you know. It's like sometimes I use it, and I don't care if anybody else does. But for myself, I don't use that term. Because it's going to affect how would we perceive a force differently if we call it the natural force community as opposed to if we call it a force ecosystem. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it makes total sense. You know, one of the aspects of all of this is how embedded we are in this scientific, capitalistic, spiritual system of beliefs, which is, for the most part, not deeply examined. The assumptions and beliefs that give us our actions in the world, there's a lot of assumptions that are just taken for granted in any aspect. So to believe that the scientific method, that it's measurable, that it's linear, that, you know, it's repeatable. Well, go back to where you're talking to the natural world. You know, some people might either think of that as either quaint or insane. And yet, look at the amount of information. Many people who spend time in the forest or backpacking or going out in the woods have amazing revelations and learning from the nature around them. That's another shade or shadow to the dreams.
And how do the trees communicate? You know? I mean, where goes back to the question, where do dreams come from? How do we know that the dreams aren't from the trees? See, that takes some faith right there to say that the dreams are from the unconscious. Maybe they are, you know, but that's
yeah, I wasn't saying that, but I mean, that would be the scientific assumption of it.
Yeah, and it takes faith, just like it takes faith to say that the dreams, or that the trees give them to us, or animals give them to us, or rocks give them to us. I mean, a couple things. One is, you were saying about the assumptions, and I read something probably, gosh, 15, 20 years ago, I don't remember where I read this, maybe this guy Robert Coombs, I'm not sure. Anyway, and it's affected my entire life and my career very deeply. Maybe one of the most influential sentences I've ever read. This guy said, unquestioned assumptions are the real authorities of any culture.
Wow.
Unquestioned assumptions are the real authorities of any culture. And, you know, late in the book, I talk about Sam Harris. I don't really like him either. He talks about, he has this essay where he's just attacking the Aztecs for human sacrifice and saying how crazy it is that they would, you know, rip the hearts out of living people, and that's how they believe that the universe would continue. And, I mean, yeah, that's pretty bad stuff, and I find it pretty disturbing on many levels. But then what about, there's 500,000 children die every year as a direct result of so-called debt repayment from the so-called third world to the so-called first world. And aren't those sacrifices? You know, what if those aren't just collateral damage, but what if those are actually sacrifices to this way of living?
Yeah.
What if that's one of the ways that this culture gets its power, is through the horrors that it perpetrates? That's one of the places I come to in the book. One of the things, you know, I was saying earlier that I think that, you know, there can be both good and bad things happen with, I mean, the other side's not just, I don't believe, are just filled with, you know, muses and dream givers and all those who wish us well. I think it's as complex as everything else. And one of the things that just blew me away years ago was I did a lot of reading about the plots to assassinate Hitler. And there was a ton of them, like 45 or something. And some of them would just fail for these seemingly absurd reasons. Like one plot didn't come off because a fly landed on someone's hand. I'm not making that up. Another plot would have worked. There was a bomb all set. It was going to go off. And then it was foggy that night, which means Hitler had to change his time. And he left at, I don't know, 8 o'clock instead of 8:30. And the bomb went off at 8:20. You know, just time after. You know, one of those is just fine, coincidence. But just like 45 times of just these extraordinary sets of occurrences. And I started to wonder, you know, so did he have like some sort of, it was like a Monty Python movie, you know, where he's walking down this castle and there's all these halberds are falling down behind him. They're all missing him. It's like, how did this happen? And I wonder, you know, this is a question, I'm not stating it, it's just a question, you know, like maybe he gained some help from somebody. And one of the reasons, you know, it's across all cultures, in order to get help from other sides, you have to give them offerings. You have to, like, that's the Aztecs, we're making offerings. And, you know, we've all heard about, in North America, a lot of times they offer tobacco. But, you know, what if Hitler was making offerings, you know, killing people in the concentration camps could buy you a lot of help if those are sacrifices. That's one of the things I ask in the book. Once again, I'm not saying it, and this is where, once again, I'm asking if, and part of this has to do with, like, how does a dominant culture keep winning? I mean, it's killing the planet. It's crazy. And they keep going. And the system is so fragile. You know, what's propping it up?
That's a great question.
And these are questions, I think, this is why I wrote the book, is because these are questions I think need to be asked. I'm not saying I have any answers. And that's part of it, is that with the stuff with dreams, it's so funny, you know, as the dentist said that immediately when I'm talking about dreams, he immediately goes to, we need to have stuff in a lab and have it be repeatable. But, of course, dreams aren't repeatable. Dreams can't be repeatable. And they're willful, and they're on their own. And that's what this book is really about, is opening out to the willfulness of the entire universe.
Yeah. You know,
what does it mean to be living in a willful universe in which this culture is then killing the planet? What does that mean? I don't know.
Well, you know, if you go to the scientists, there isn't any meaning inherent. That's another question, is, does any of this have any meaning, the existential question? When we hear from all these different shades and places, what are the voices really saying, and where are they coming from? And, you know, I think it was a great question you repeated many times and tried to answer it many different ways. Why is the dominant culture continuing to destroy and winning? And why is the enslavement of the other species? And why aren't the people, like the indigenous people who have the wisdom, able to overcome the forces of darkness? I don't know the answer, but
one answer that an indigenous person gave me was, perhaps the beings on the other side have been just as stunned at this culture's voraciousness and relentlessness as a lot of the indigenous people were. And, you know, it's really not fair of me to say that, you know, if the earth really is sentient, why hasn't it fought back? Because that's implying that the fact that it hasn't fought back, or it has fought back, actually, but the fact that it hasn't won doesn't mean it's not sentient. That's really insulting, because we can say the same thing about a domestic violence situation. You know, some man is beating up his wife or his girlfriend, and she doesn't stop him, and does that mean that she's not sentient? No, it could mean that she was so stunned. I mean, it's like, you know, one of the things that, you know, my father's extremely violent, and one of the things that my mom has said, one of the things that really surprised her, she says the one thing that her parents did that was really not helpful is they never taught her that there were evil people in the world. And so she was completely taken by surprise. And of course, then had children. You know, she had children to try to figure out what's going to happen. There weren't bad women's shelters. So maybe part of the reason that the earth hasn't won is because it was just so taken aback, and it takes a while to figure out an appropriate response. I don't know. I want to go a different direction for just a second, which is there's one of my favorite lines in the book, and one of the most important lines, which goes to the depth of this culture's problems, is at one point, and this has to do with unquestioned assumptions, at one point Richard Dawkins says, science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command and to predict what will happen and when. And that's reasonably true in terms of science. You know, one of the reasons we know science works is because if you turn on a switch, then the electricity comes on, you know, and you can make matter and energy jump through hoops on command by pushing switches or by using a backhoe or whatever. And that's all true, but at the same time, the thing that it ignores, a couple things. One is that it's completely sociopathological. And another is that it ignores that some forms of truth can mask or destroy other forms of truth. And what I mean by that is, let's say that you and I are sitting in a room, and let's say I pull out a gun, and I aim the gun at you, and I would say, so I would like for you to jump through a hoop right now. And you jump through that hoop, because I've got a gun on you, I'm going to kill you if you don't. You jump through the hoop, and you know, what do you know? I'm a genius, because I just predicted you're going to jump through a hoop on command, and you did it. I predicted what would happen and when. But if I do that to you, wouldn't that also be possibly destroying our relationship? And wouldn't that possibly be masking other forms of knowledge? Maybe you will jump through a hoop when I tell you to, but you're not going to be my friend. Do you see what I'm getting at with that?
Yeah, yeah, that line, by the way, jumped out at me when you wrote it too.
And so that's just one of the things that's really important. I'm not saying that science isn't true as such. I mean, of course, if you, you know, mix certain things together, you're going to end up with concrete. You know, it's like, I'm not pretending concrete doesn't happen. I'm not pretending that you can't make a telephone, but then we can talk, you know, across all these miles. Of course you can.
But people are unwilling to acknowledge that science itself is a closed loop system. And when you're bringing in these other shades and these other things such as dreams and communicating with nature and all of these things and the whole aspect of faith, you know, I don't know what kind of faith grass has or your bear has or what that, but I know at the heart of conversations I have when I listen deeply to what someone says, somewhere you're going to find that there was a jump of faith. There was a leap of faith that happened.
Right, absolutely.
On Thursday, I'm talking to Ed Moses. I don't know if you know Dr. Ed Moses at Lawrence Livermore, but there's about to be a major breakthrough in fusion technology.
Oh, no.
And that's what I said. That's exactly what I said, Derek. I said, if we have a breakthrough in free, clean energy, all that will do is accelerate the destruction of the planet, given the mindset that we have, that it will, you know, want to produce more gadgets to sell and take more resources, create more destruction of the planet, more waste that the planet can't absorb. And yet we're within a year of probably being able to do that. And of course, I'm thinking of the science thing. They've got these football field long lasers that hit the pellet the size of a Viagra pill. I use that on purpose, that gets,
yeah, I was
going to
say, nice choice.
That gets in the inside of it is hotter than the surface of the sun. We're playing with, literally playing with fire here with these things. And
Wait a second. What could possibly go wrong?
Right. What could go wrong? Yeah. It's just hotter than the face of the sun. And, you know, so it made me think one of the things you talk about, and I'm going to shift a little bit here because I think in the environmental world that we've been around for a long time, particularly me being getting kind of old, we've been talking about sustainability and sustainable development. And I loved your take on sustainable development. First of all, I think that people are unaware of last year, in spite of all the efforts that we've had, was the highest year of carbon emissions on the planet. Last year, we had more devastation, whether you're looking at the melting glaciers, whether you're looking at the water pollution of the pure water, wherever direction you go, last year was a banner year. And yet we're still talking about this idea of sustainable development. And somewhere in there is why I talked about Ed Moses, who I'm interviewing Thursday, is this idea that technology will save us. And of course, Thomas Berry talks about that we're in a technological trance. Can you talk about this concept of sustainable development in relationship to the destruction that we continue to do to the planet?
Well, I just saw a cartoon on Survival International's page, and Survival International is a organization that is to help preserve, protect traditional indigenous peoples. And it's a cartoon about all these sustainable development people want to go into this indigenous community where the people are just living in a forest and hanging out. And I was like, nah, we're okay, thanks. Like, no, you need this. And they keep pushing it. And then at the end, the forest is cut down. The people now have to work jobs and live in you know, compounds. And people who are perpetrating the whole thing have, by the end of the cartoon, stopped talking about sustainable development, only talking about development. And, I mean, it's just every time. And in dreams, I talk about sustainable development as just a modern version of white man's burden. And white man's burden was a piece by Rudyard Kipling about how, oh, it's so hard to be a white person because you have to civilize all the savages. And it's just so hard. And, of course, it ignores the fact that you're stealing from them. You're destroying their way of life, et cetera, et cetera. And they don't really, you know, you're, quote, you're civilizing them, quote, at the point of a gun. And sustainable development is the same thing. It's just an excuse for more technologization. And the Adivasis, the indigenous peoples of India, don't want it. That's why they're joining with the Maoists to fight back. And years ago, I interviewed a member of the Tupac Amaristas. It's a rebel group from Peru. And I said, what do you want for the people of Peru? And he said something very simple, which is, we want to be able to grow and develop. We want to be able to grow and distribute our own food. We already know how to do that. We merely need to be allowed to do so. And that's the entire struggle right there, is what traditional indigenous peoples want the world over. I can't speak for them, but I think this is pretty safe to say that what they want is to be left alone. And they want for their lives to continue. I just saw, did you see the picture that came out of the tribal chief crying as he learned that the president of Brazil, I believe it was, gave the go-ahead for that big dam? The point is that there's a great, you can put that together with, I sent this to an indigenous friend of mine, that there's that photo, and then there's a photo from, I think, 1958 of an American Indian man crying as the Department of the Interior signs this order to build a dam on his land.
Yeah.
And when I wrote that to my indigenous friend, I said, this is it. This is the whole story right here. Nothing has changed. You know, it's still indigenous people being pushed off their land for so-called development. And it used to be, once again, that it was the white people's job to civilize the savages. And now it's the white people's job to develop the undeveloped. And I even hate that term development in that sense, because if you look it up in the dictionary, development means to become something better, bigger, fuller, like to become more itself. Like a caterpillar develops into a butterfly. A child develops into an adult. That's a correct usage. But a forest does not develop into white box houses.
Right.
And so that's a young forest that develops into an older forest. I mean, that's what happens. Or you could even say that a pond, as it eutrophies, a pond will eventually become a wetland. You know, it will develop into wetland because over time, you know, the pond will fill in. That's just what happens. And those are proper uses of that. So development is a big scam. And so far as the technologization, one of the things I talk about in the book, and I don't believe this at all, but I say this one of the possibilities because it scares me and it seems like it's happening, is that maybe the machines are actually in charge. And what I mean by that is, you know, if you look at it, the real beneficiaries of this culture are machines. It's not even human beings, because the vast majority of human beings are being harmed. I mean, the toxic sea in China for building windmills, and people working jobs they don't like. It's this treadmill that's just crazy. And of course, this is not just me talking about this. This is Lewis Mumford's basic analysis who's that sociologist? A great sociologist, blind. I can't remember the guy's name right now. But he says, in the past, the man was first. In the future, the system will be first.
I don't know who that is.
It's like this whole system is just self-perpetuating when it's not even benefiting, you know, when they're actually fracking or wanting to frack the water supply of New York City, which is
that's
the center
amazing.
Of empire.
Is that amazing? I'm just, like, flabbergasted that that's even...
yeah. I mean, it's bad enough when they destroy the water supply of somebody out in the colonies. That is reprehensible. It's everything else, but at least from a colonialist, narcissistic, sociopathic mindset, you can understand it. But to frack their own water supply.
Yeah.
I mean, clearly, the question has to be asked, who's in charge?
Yeah, well, who is in charge? That's one other piece of it is this whole fascination with the idea of progress. We seem to have this unshakable fascination with continuous progress. I mean, even the political party I'm most associated with are called progressives. And I'm wondering, you know, how this notion of progress continues to influence the domination and enslavement of all the other life on the planet. And it's such an embedded, talk about an unexamined belief, it's so embedded into our economic, into our development, quote, systems, into our system of government and commerce. What's your thought about the relationship of that, the whole idea of progress?
Well, the Talua, you know, I live on Talua Indian land here, and the Talua lived here for 12,500 years, if you believe what science tells you. If you believe what the Talua tell you, they lived here since the beginning of time. But either way, they lived here for 12,500 years. And when the first whites arrived, about 1830, 1840, the place was a paradise. You know, the huge salmon runs, the place wasn't being destroyed. And, you know, we see this everywhere. And the Talua the reason they didn't invent backhoes is not because they were too stupid, you know. They had an entirely different set of mythologies that were cyclical, that weren't based on progress. And this notion of progress is can never be sustainable, because sustainability requires a steady state. And further, I use the term progress for technological progress, but in the book I talk about how I would prefer to use the term technological escalation, because it's really what it is. It's not progress sounds good, or at the very least, progress sounds value neutral. But the truth is that a lot of things can progress. A stalker can progress from, you know, sort of doing little things up until they can kill somebody, you know, or domestic violence can progress. And we have to look at it in that sense. And then also, what really is what I would call technological escalation, what people would call technological progress. That's an increase in the capacity to make others jump through hoops on command. It's an increase in the capacity to control. And if you're the one who's doing the controlling, well, that can seem like progress, and that can seem like a pretty good deal. But if you're the one who's being controlled, I don't think that seems like such a good deal anymore. I don't think that that seems like I would call it progress. If you are attempting to control me, and at first you can only do it with a club, you know, you can beat me up when I'm not doing what you say, and then later on you have a bunch of technological advancements, so now I've got a shock collar on, you might call that progress. I don't think I'd call that progress. I would call that increased enslavement.
Yeah.
And so, you know, to use a cliche, you know, the old, and it's a terrible cliche, but the old one about, you know, it depends on whose ox is being gored. You know, it's like, once again, from the perspective, this is one of the reasons, you know, I always say that all the so-called solutions to global warming have one thing in common, the ones put forward by, you know, we always hear about, which is they take industrial capitalism as a given, and the natural world is that which must conform to industrial capitalism. And then,
yeah, so again, they're starting from a flawed assumption that continuous growth is the only way to continue to survive as a civilization, quote.
Well, even as a, but that's the thing, is they're, what they're trying to protect is civilization, and they're not trying to protect the planet.
I know,
and
very,
if
very clear.
And if Hamilton Sharks were going to give a solution to global warming, I don't think they would take industrial capitalism as a given. And the same with subsistence farmers in India. And my point really is, those are all those solutions are coming from the narrative of the perpetrators of the problem in the first place. Just like the narrative of technological progress comes from the perpetrators of that technological escalation in the first place.
Right.
And we need to question those. And, you know, I agree with you that we're enthralled. I mean, I think that was the word you used, which is an accurate word in terms of thrall, in terms of slavery. And we're addicted. You know, it's like a lot of my students at the prison used to say that at first the meth or the heroin would serve them, and pretty soon they were serving the meth or the heroin. And it's the same thing with the technology, that we at this point are serving the technology, and that's really sad, and it's worse than sad, it's murderous, you know, it's killing the planet. And I don't know if this happens to you, but I gotta tell you, I wake up, I mean, all the time, I keep thinking, well, this is all just a bad dream, they can't actually be, you know, 90% of large fish in the oceans can't be gone, you know, it's like, staid people are saying that the oceans could be dead within 50, 60 years, and I can't get my mind around that.
There's not a day go by that I don't have that same feeling, Derek, and I so appreciate your ability to put it into words. You're quite prolific. I want to promote the new book, Dreams. It, of course, expands on all your previous themes in Endgame and Deep Green Resistance and the story, forgot the name of it, Story Older Than Words. Is that what it was?
Language older than words.
Language older than words, right. So, but we're going to have to cut it off, Derek, my friend, and I really appreciate you making yourself available to be on Conversations, your work, and I look forward to having you on again really soon.
Well, I would love to be on again, and I also want to say that I don't think that my job in this interview was as good as the last time we were on, and I want to take responsibility. You were just as great. But this is the first interview I've done on dreams, and so that's a wonderful yay, yay, yay special thing. At the same time, I think I wasn't quite as sharp as I could have been because I think I need to practice.
Yeah, well, you know what? We're going to need to sit down and get to know each other face-to-face a little bit, so I look forward to that opportunity.
Thanks.
And you take care, and thanks so much again.
Thanks so much. You did a great job.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Conversations is an independently produced program supported by KVMR 89.5 Nevada City and listener contributions. We are committed to bringing you leading-edge thinking in the areas of environmental restoration, social justice, and spiritual fulfillment. If you would like to receive our complimentary newsletter, The Well of Light, make a contribution, or order any of our past shows, please call 530-477-7757 or go to our website at rwelistening.net.